Good morning, everybody. My name's Carla Rowland, and I'm an alcoholic. And I feel that way about you too, Vivian, my sister from another mother. We get lucky. I don't like everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't have something in common with everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous except that one thing that, thank God, brings us into this room, alcoholism. But we get lucky on the way, don't we? And we get to meet these people that we really click with on so many levels and so many dimensions. And all the way across the country, I know I'm loved, and I hope you do too. Thank you. I want to thank the committee for inviting my husband to come share with you, and then he brought me along. That happens a lot these days. We got together about 6 years ago and then got married, and so when one of us gets invited to speak, we'll usually say, hey, do you have all your speakers? And I know a good one. And the last and the last time somebody did that for me, and I said, well, hey, do you have all your speakers? And she says, well, no, not quite yet. And I said, well, my husband's, you know how this is going to sound, right? Well, my husband's a really good speaker. Yeah, well, sure, everybody wants to go to Hilton Head. But this was going somewhere else, and I said, you got all your speakers? And she said, no. And I said, well, how about my husband? He's a great speaker. And she said, is he in the room? Is he in the room there with you? No. That happened, and I got to come along, and grateful to be here in Hilton Head. Thank you, committee, and Bill, and Cheryl, and thank you, Vivian, for chairing the meeting, and thank you, Lee and Jimmy, for coming out and recording this whole thing. And we have a few friends here too. I know some of the ladies here from Ladybug and parts surrounding. And it's really good to be here with Matthew and Bill and Magdalena. It's like a reunion. So thank you for that. I really don't know how I'm going to start out yet. I've seen these speakers before who say, well, I really don't know how I'm going to start out, so now I know how they feel. Alcoholics Anonymous is everything that I do and that I think and that I am. Everything about my life these days is launched from 12 steps, 12 traditions, and 12 concepts. My whole foundation of living is launched from Alcoholics Anonymous. Was my portal through which I came to find a connection, to access and maintain a connection with a power greater than myself. And I always knew that power existed, but I just could never stay connected. Just couldn't. Some challenge would happen at home, and I'd pull the shade down between me and it. You know, just, and I didn't even know I was doing it, but I thought it was God. I thought it was God getting mad at me or something. But so Alcoholics Anonymous was my portal, and if you're new, you might think, oh my God, how big can your life really be to be launched simply on a foundation of these 36 principles? How big can your life possibly be? But I got to tell you that before, when I was out there running free and easy and there were no limits and no rules and no boundaries, and if it feels good, do it, my life just continued to get smaller and smaller and smaller. And I come in here and I follow a few simple rules. I take a certain simple attitude, and my life just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's very simple. Not easy, but very simple. My sobriety date, September 25th, 1987. Before that, I never did anything for 28 years in a row on purpose that was of any value. I had to come to AA to learn how to live a life. And it wasn't that I didn't believe. I was doing a lot of things out there, drinking and using, that I didn't believe in, but I just couldn't get. I couldn't get to. You could not use the words Carla and good character in the same sentence. And it was not who I wanted to be. I just didn't know how to get to who it was I really am. And when we talk about transformation these days, we hear a lot about that. We hear that word all the time. Transformation, it happens. Miracles, we take them for granted. You know, we go, how'd you get from there to here? And we believe it because it's true. We know what's happened for each one of us at some level. And when we talk about transformation, really for me, my experience has been over 28 years that I am not so much becoming something else. I am just more the person I was intended to be in the first place by letting go of the things I'm not. And it's a journey. And if you're new, I hope that you stay and experience this. I hope that you just stay. My husband and I have a lot of fun. We well, like I said, we got together 6 years ago, and because we are not all that bright all the time, we ran together in the same circles, or ran in the same circles for a long time. We knew each other very well before, or very long before we got together, but we had to go to Arizona to start talking. We live in California. Had to go to Arizona to start talking, and we got together, and he's very proud of me. He's very, very proud of the person I've become. We go to these places, these different conferences and stuff, and a year or so ago, we were out there walking on the boardwalk in Ocean City, Maryland, and just killing some time, you know, walking up and down the sidewalk there, and he's a motorcycle aficionado, rode for about 50 years, and he sees this Harley-Davidson being raffled off by this at this kiosk by the Lions Club. So he sees, spots this Harley, and you know, if you're a rider, you just whoop, radiate right to it. And he walked over there and he said, "Hey, honey, it only takes one ticket to win." And I thought, "Well, you go right ahead, honey. You win that Harley, and we'll sell it and fix the kitchen." You know what I mean? So he goes over and he's filling out the name on the ticket, and the guy said, "Hey, wow, you're a long way from home, aren't you?" And he said, "Yeah, we're from California, but we're out here at an AA conference." And they said, "AA, American Airlines?" And he said, "No, we're at an Alcoholics Anonymous convention." And they said, "Well, wow, what do you do at an AA conference?" And he said, "Well, we share about our experience, strength, and hope, what we were like, what happened, and what we're like today, and all the changes that have come about, and we don't drink anymore." And they said, "Wow." And he said, "Yeah, for instance, my wife, she used to be a prostitute." So I'm just scrolling my phone because I've met him before. I know that anything can come out of. So I'm scrolling and I can still hear him, and he says, "But it's okay now, because all these years later, she's going to be a massage therapist." And if you're new, that might not sound like it's all that long a distance to travel, but I got to tell you. When I was out there, I had not much interest in becoming a massage therapist. But I've run the gamut in 28 years. I've just, you know, you told me to do the next indicated thing, and like Matthew said last night, and I love this, it isn't always pretty. It's like, it's not always done with dignity and grace. Who said that? You know, I mean, it's lovely if we can. I have loved learning how to act like an adult. What I'm really loving these days is learning how to actually feel like an adult. You know, I love that. I love that when I'm actually not mad, or when I'm actually happy for you getting something that maybe I'm not getting at the moment. You know, I love it when it's act. Because see, I can come in here and it's valuable. When I first got here, I learned how to stack chairs and be in the middle and do the right thing and share and help people and all of that, and look really, really good in Alcoholics Anonymous. But as we all probably will find out, I know I did, mine is the head I go home with. So I can, all the looking good and doing the right things inside these rooms is not going to do any good if I'm walking out crazy. And so I've got to do the work. I have to take the steps. I can't just be active. I can't just be in the middle physically. I've got to do something. Something has to happen inside. So, and it's still happening, and I'm still here. And I never, like I said, I was never consistent at anything, not for 28 years. But Alcoholics Anonymous has always had something in here for me. And I'm not one of those people who believes that I just go to meetings to give anymore. I go to give, but I go to get too, because I continue to receive. I continue to. There's always something in here. I'm always uplifted. So, the best description of alcoholism still to this day, I believe I've ever seen, is on page 44 in our book, Alcoholics Anonymous. If when you honestly want to find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. Boom. If that's you, welcome. Welcome. There are a lot of descriptions of alcoholism going around, and I relate to a lot of them. But without that one component, you know, it's really neuroses. You know, and a lot of alcoholics are neurotic, but not every neurotic is an alcoholic. And we have a singleness of purpose here, and it doesn't mean that a lot of other things don't go on in the fellowship and that they aren't relevant. But I need to remember singleness of purpose, because it was somebody who shared the message with me about not being able to stop drinking. That was my problem. I don't eat 50 cookies. I don't drink a case of Diet Pepsi. I don't have those kinds of things. I don't even overindulge in everything I pick up. But when you talk about alcohol, and when I discovered what alcohol did for me when I was very, very young, man, you know, I started drinking when I was 11 with a purpose, and I was 29 years old when I got sober. So for that, for a long, long time, I was in trouble, and I was drinking, and alcohol was dictating everything I did in my life. Everything. Telling me to let go of the things that I love, telling me to that it's just not going to matter because this makes it. Alcohol made me feel it was my spirituality, it was my God, it was my growing up, it was my maturity. I didn't have to grow up if I allowed alcohol to do what it did for me. And I let everything that was valuable to me go. Any God-given talents or potential gifts that I had, I'd begun to trade away at an early age for the effect that alcohol produced. So if that's you, if alcohol has that effect on you, I get a little scared, and I've started to talk about it a little more. I hear people say, well, it's not about alcohol. And I think, really? Really, because there are 11 and a half steps that we take to protect that first half of the first step. If I don't have my physical sobriety, then I'm in trouble. Because it's that first one that I had to come to AA to learn that it's the first one that gets me drunk. I didn't know that. I just kept thinking if I could keep it down to 6, 10, 15. And never could. So it does have that to do with alcohol. Everything that we do in here protects that first half of the first step. If I don't keep my physical sobriety, then, and Bill says in the chapter, The Doctor's Opinion, that any description of alcoholism that leaves out this physical component is incomplete. So yes, in order to keep my physical sobriety, I've got to have a spiritual solution. For me, it took a spiritual solution, and this is what I do. But I have to remember why. I can't safely ingest alcohol in any form at all, not mouthwash form, not food form, not any kind of form, not like that. So anyway, my mother was a single mother of two girls. We moved around a lot for the rent, and when I got here, I thought it was kind of important to try to figure out why I was an alcoholic. I thought maybe it had something to do with my crazy, dark, dramatic, violent, perverted family. You know, if you had my family, you'd drink too. And I've come to find out that that'll give you an inventory, but it didn't make me alcoholic. And we moved around a lot for the rent, and I was okay with that for a while. For me, it just seemed like, you know, you just adjust. We'd go from school to school, and whatever it was we were doing at school, I was kind of social too. You know, we'd go to school. If we were playing softball, I wanted to do that. I was athletic. If we were doing academics, I wanted to do that. I loved learning in school. And if we were running track, let's do that. And I've got a competitive bone too. That doesn't make me alcoholic. That might be a trait, but it's a trait of a lot of other people too, a lot of people in the Olympics running, you know, very competitive, and they don't drink. But I was a little kid, I became a little kid with big dreams. You know, I wanted to eventually become the first woman to run a 4-minute mile, which was interesting because I hated running, but I loved to win, you know. And playing softball, wanted to be the first woman Major League Baseball player, wanted to be the first woman president, you know. By the time sixth grade was over, I was tired. I needed a drink, you know. But the deal was, when I took a drink, it worked. And it doesn't do that for 90% of the population. I am different. I am bodily and mentally different from my fellows when it comes to alcohol. Maybe other things too, but for here, for the purposes of this room, this gathering, this fellowship, that's, I need to know that. I got my first social resentment behind a game of spin the bottle. I know, I know they don't even play that game these days. They just get right down to business, don't they? And we were at my friend Leonard's house. We were playing Spin the Bottle. It was that summer before seventh grade, going up into, you know, middle school or whatever they call it now. And we were just had a few boys, a few girls over at his house, and passing around a bottle of his dad's whiskey. And the bottle we were spinning landed on me, and I went off into the bedroom with one of the boys, and we were both doing the same thing as far as I could tell. But when we came back out of that bedroom, they called him a player and me a slut. And I did not think that was fair. I still don't think it's fair if you want to know the truth, but every sponsor I've ever had has told me the fair comes around once a year and it lasts 2 weeks. That's all you get for fair. So, you know, my inability to accept things as they are, and I never understood those unwritten rules, you know, I had, and some of that came from background, you know, I'd had a lot of babysitters, boyfriends coming through the house, you know, and I had a family member who had been molesting me, and plus it was a sexual revolution, it was the end of the 60s, and so all of these ideas that I'm just drawing conclusions from, you know, and I come into this pretty conservative neighborhood and find out, you know, that I don't understand the unwritten rules of good girls do and say they don't, or don't and say they do, or something like that. I still don't think I have that right, but I got a reputation I didn't understand, nor could I take responsibility for, and a reputation like that goes through junior high like wildfire. And the boys my age were treating me funny and looking at me funny, and so were the girls. And after a while, I fight for a while, my pride kicked in, my feelings got hurt, and I started to back away from my life. Just started to let go and trying to live that double life, you know, at 11 years old already, of trying to hang on to the things I loved and still drink. Softball had to go. I was a majorette for a little while, twirling a baton, had to go. Everything that I loved had to go. I started spending more time in the girls' room than I did in the classroom, hanging out with those other girls who were doing the same thing, bringing stuff from our mother's medicine cabinets and from their liquor cabinets, and hanging out until after a while, my last bastion of refuge, school, where I went to have everything be okay, was not okay anymore. And so I started to take my life into my own hands, and I am a self-propeller. I've got some great solutions that soon become my next problem, but I started to find my hope out on the open road, because way back then my favorite place to be was on my way to somewhere else, and I loved it, just loved it. You know, I'd get out there under the open sky on the on-ramps of the 10 freeway coming east or the 101 going north, and I'd stick my little thumb out on that on-ramp, and I'd crawl in the car or the truck going wherever with whoever, and I'd be on my way to somewhere else. And I love that feeling. That feeling for me was hope. Hope is just up the road. You know, I didn't even have to, it felt like the bottle in the glove compartment, where I didn't even have to have that bottle open to already feel better. You know, I didn't even have to know what I was going to do when I got there. I already felt better. Consequently, because I was so young, I started ending up in some of the Southern California hot spots, like Indio Jail and Riverside Juvenile Hall and L.A. Central and like that. We did that whole deal for a while. And when I was 14, I left home one more time with a friend of mine, and we got one long ride all the way up into this little party town, this little district of San Francisco called North Beach, and the guy dropped us off right in the middle, and God, we looked to my left, and there was Carol Doda's flashing boobs and the Condor Club, and to my right were hookers and dealers and pimps, oh my, and it just, bright lights, big city, you know, and we weren't on that street for 10 minutes before a couple of guys approached us, offered us money for sex, and we said yes and did the next indicated thing, and boom, a whole new career path opened up for us. And I started living a day at a time in a way I've not had to live in a very, very long time. And Dr. Silkworth talks about in the chapter, The Doctor's Opinion, that after a while we can't differentiate the true from the false. After a while, our alcoholic lives seemed the only normal one. Everything that alcohol said to do. If you had asked me back then, I would have said I was doing it willingly. It's just the next indicated step. I take a drink. I've got delusions. The drink preserves the delusions. And then I drink to live through the delusions. A year later, I was being admitted to a mental hospital. Everything about the way that I saw my life lived, any hopes, any dreams, any beliefs I had were shattered, absolutely shattered. I needed some new ones badly, but I didn't have them. And I was pretty broken. And they were not talking to me a lot about alcoholism. They were talking to me about disorders. I was a very disordered-looking child. I was supposed to to be at this hospital for 2 weeks observation. I ended up being there for a year. I just sort of made myself at home and moved in. It was not a treatment center, it was a mental hospital. So a lot of my roommates had real illnesses, real manic depression, real schizophrenia, the real deal. And for a while, untreated, when I've got no booze and I've got no steps or fellowship or God on my understanding, I'm restless, irritable, and discontent, violent. And by that time, just these ideas have blown up in my whole being. So they're giving me daily nutritional supplements, Thorazine, Melaril, Valium, Dalmane sleepers, just trying to calm me down until we can figure it out, you know, like how to identify this. I become intimately familiar with five-point restraints, and that's what I look like at 15. And if you don't want to go crazy in the nut house, you got to get busy. And one of my favorite, and I have always been a self-motivator, self-propelling. If you don't want to go crazy in the nut house, you got to get busy. One of my favorite ways to be busy was the boys. I loved all the boys, but my favorites were those sexy, smoldering types, you know. You know the kind. They just sit back there and simmer. You know what I mean? You just never really knew when they were going to blow. God, I used to find them so exciting. Now, today I know that feeling is fear. So I stay away. But guys like that in the nut house are always blowing. They blow eventually. They're hiding from a junior prison sentence. They got nothing. And they don't want to go to California Youth Authority. So they try to lay low till they just can't anymore. Like my first boyfriend, he eventually blew up and he threw a chair through the big plate glass window of the boys' unit. And my next boyfriend, he blew and he threw a nurse through the big plate glass window of the boys' unit. So that was progressive too. And I don't know about you, but I've always thought I should have a soundtrack to my life. You know, music playing in the background of all this drama going on. You know, one day Bob Dylan following you around with a little minstrel show, you know, just singing a ballad, setting the tone. Another day, maybe a mariachi band because it's a little bit more festive, you know. Some days, just flat out rock and roll. Or if I'm in a really, really, really big pile of self-pity, Janis Joplin, right? Cry, cry, baby. We'd play those sentimental jailhouse songs like, "Whoo, when will I see you again?" Press our little faces up against the big bay window of the girls' unit, looking out there, looking back at us through their window. Living in that sweet spot of anticipation. You know what I'm talking about. As soon as I get that, I'm going to be okay. Just as soon as I, if only I, when I... It's never in the getting. Never in the getting, is it? As soon as you get it, you got to get another one. That one's not right. It's that anticipation. Matthew talked about that last night. Just the almost. I didn't understand what I came looking for, I came looking with. I didn't understand that what I was looking for was already inside me. So I'm always looking out there for what I think is going to fix me. And the trouble with that is I'm always about half a bubble off what it is I think I see. Like I'd mistake arrogance for confidence, I'd mistake sex for love, I'd mistake brute strength for strength of character, and I'd get it up in my hot little hands and it would dissolve where I stood because it wasn't it. I had to come to AA to learn that it's when I'm thinking of you, that getting out of self, seeing what I can give, constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. That's what makes that feeling of conscious separation disappear. When I'm thinking of you, I'm not thinking of me. I remember one afternoon I was sitting outside on the smoke break bench watching my boyfriend Terry being cuffed and escorted off by security. He's the one who threw the chair through the window and he's gone. He's gone and I'm heartbroken, right? You know, because this was a serious relationship, you know, 2-3 weeks or something. It was pretty invested, you know. And I'm smoking my tragic cigarettes and I'm channeling Greta Garbo. Watching this whole thing go down, and just inside the girls' unit, I could hear Diana Ross singing at top decibel, "Touch Me in the Morning," then just walk away. It took me a long time to realize I was brokenhearted and blue before I ever had a real date. It's the way I see my life. And I love that Bill wrote about that. He said, we avoid the deliberate manufacture of misery. We avoid that. Did you know that? We avoid that now. But not then, boy. I thought that's right where we go. You know, that's a sweet spot. Ah, that sweet hurt. Like I said, I spent a year in that place, and I spent most of my adolescent life in one lockup or another. Why? Because I get back out on the street for just a minute, and I am right back doing the very things that got me locked up in the first place. And that is plain insanity. Lack of proportional thinking. I just had no, my solutions were worse than my problems. And somewhere along the line, being locked up like that, I had begun to start to surrender to the thought that maybe I am just one of those little nuthouse lifers, that every now and then I'm going to get out, but I am always, always, always going to end up back inside. So maybe I better just get used to that. At the end of all of that, I ended up in a girl's home, and they're trying to teach us how to live out in the world, and I'm still, my head's kind of ringing, you know, and again, through all of this, I never stopped looking for that answer, for that power greater than myself, or making that connection. I never stopped. I was born into a Southern Baptist family. That religion worked very well for my mother till the day she died 6 years ago. You know, it just, and all these years later, I kind of developed some resentments of religion after a while, and then after all this time being sober, I'm not against religion. I have no resentments really against religion any more than I do in AA and people. You know, it's, everybody has ego, everybody has spirit, and it's all in how we use it. And it can happen in AA, it can happen in church. I know just as many miracles that have happened in church and out there with non-alcoholics as in here. I don't think we're the privileged chosen few, which I think is very funny in Alcoholics Anonymous. We come in here and we think God doesn't like us, and we've been separated from him for, you know, years, and he doesn't like me, or when he finds me, he's going to kill me and all of that. And then like 3 months later, we're his favorite, you know. It's like, okay. You know, he doesn't even think about those other people. You know, and that's just, I don't understand a God like that. If God loves me, he's got to love everybody. So I got to reach for that. It's my limited brain that can't see it. And so, so every day I got to loosen my grip on how I think those things are. But I tried, you know, I tried being a Catholic for a couple of weeks in the fourth grade. You know, I saw all my friends were Catholic around me, and they all had confirmation and communion and all of those things. They had wore little white dresses and books and rosaries and all of that stuff. And I thought, maybe that's what's working, you know. Forgot about that for a while and burned black candles for a couple of years and prayed to the other guy, you know, just hedging my bets, really. I just want to be on the side that's winning, you know. I didn't care. Then the television series Kung Fu came out. You guys remember him? David Carradine played a Buddhist priest named Kane. And that guy was tough, you know. He walked the Wild West in bare feet. You know, just walked from town to town, just looking ever so cool. Had that little bag. I don't know what was in that bag on his belt. And sometimes because he looked different, he'd walk to a town and he'd be greeted with great hostility by a whole group of guys, you know, and they'd walk up to him and assault him verbally. And he'd stand there and just pearls of wisdom rolled off his tongue. He just looked very cool, you know. And they would hear these words and you'd see their faces change and they'd go off to help people. And I thought, my God, that's power. That's real power. And then he'd walk to another town, and this time he'd be assaulted by another whole group of guys, and this time they'd assault him physically. And when they did that, he kicked their ass. And I wanted what he had. It was my idea of strength and serenity, personified. You know, if I could just do that, you know, I could be cool and kick your ass. So by the time I got to this girl's home, I meet my roommate, and we're on the same page. You know, we are flying on the coattails of the 60s. You know, it was the early 70s. Well, now it's the mid-70s, but I was 12 in 1969, so the 60s were over by the time I got out in the world, but I still had that in my... You know, I used to watch the news, and I love those people. I love that spirit. You know, people didn't take crap back then. They stood up and marched. Thousands, by the thousands, they marched, and they played that beautiful music, Cream and Traffic and Blind Faith and those songs of hope and strength. And they had peace and love, free love and flowers, and there were none of those boundaries anymore that called people sluts or players or any of that stuff. It was just everybody loved everybody, I thought. And my friend, we're on the same page, and we're talking to our other friends who are a little bit older, and they said, man, those people went to Oregon. And I thought, well, there are people and they're in Oregon. San Francisco's gone to seed, so we went out the second story window of that girl's home, down the tree and into Randy's truck and off to Oregon where God might be. And we went up there and landed in Eugene, Springfield area, and my friends rented a house and let me come with them. And you know, I don't know about you, but I never went anywhere new thinking, let's go screw this up too. You know, I went somewhere thinking, fresh start, clean slate, I'm going to make it new, we're going to do it right. We planted a garden in the front yard, we're going to get back to the land. That's when I learned that when they talk about hoeing in Oregon, they meant with a tool. It was just a whole different thing. The two things happened while I was up there that I certainly couldn't see while it was happening. One of them was we couldn't always drink the way I needed to drink, and I didn't even know this. When I've got no steps, fellowship, God of my understanding, and I don't have a drink, I am restless, irritable, and discontent. My reliance on alcohol already so strong that when you take it away, I've got nothing. I've got nothing. Alcohol was my absolute maturity, my spirituality, everything. And when I could drink the way I needed a drink, I was always overshooting the mark. And that was happening again and still at 17. I couldn't take one without having to have another and another and another. And eventually my friends had to ask me to leave. And I was asked to leave a lot. And I ended up in a roundabout way against my father's better judgment in his house again. And we hadn't been together for a few years, but he let me come stay for just a few months. It was all he could stand. And we'd get up at the same time every morning and he'd leave for work and I'd go sit in his den and drink from his liquor cabinet. And he'd come back home in the afternoon and he'd see me sitting in the very spot where he'd left me that morning. And I'd see that broken-hearted look in his eyes and I'd have nothing to say for myself. I didn't even know what the question was, really. And that lasted, like I said, just a few months. He came to me right before my 18th birthday and said what I know were the hardest words he ever had to say, and that's, I'm not going to watch you die and I'm not going to help you do it. You got to go. On my way out the door, all I could remember is that one of the counselors at the rehab had told me I was a great actress. And I know today I must have misunderstood, because I ended up on Hollywood Boulevard and there is not a lot of auditioning going on out there. I was 18 years old and starting my days off with a pint of pop-off vodka, and I would go wherever the day took me. And some days it's a party and some days it's just surviving. And there was not a lot of hope about it getting any different. And it just, again, our alcoholic life seemed the only normal one. I just went from one thing to the next to the next. A few months into that, I met a man walking down Hollywood Boulevard, and I saw the light in his eyes, and I didn't realize it was orange sunshine, but we hit it off, and I moved in with him that night, and I didn't even know his last name. And 6 weeks later, he's asking me to leave, and I still don't know his last name. But I like to bring him up because years later, he was on my eight-step list. He was someone who came to my mind very quickly and clearly that I owed him amends. And I loved that. I really loved getting one right on my first inventory in my first year, because as much as I really wanted to do well in this program and stay sober and it was working, my first inventory still went a lot like this. Your fault, your fault, your fault, me. Your fault, your fault, your fault, me. You know, it took me a while to see some of the other things, but I did see that. I saw what I did. I knew what I needed to do to make it right. And I spent the last part of my first year of sobriety looking all over for him. And of course I couldn't find him. And my sponsor finally said, look, you're just chasing your tail now. If you're supposed to find that guy, you'll find him, but in God's time, not yours. So stop trying to force it and just move along with what you're doing now. And she said, if you really want to change the way your life is going, she said, there are some things that you can do as well. And she said, like, why don't you try being a friend to a man in a vertical fashion? And why don't you start there? That's not in the big book, but it's a good idea. And I love that. You know, I mean, there were simple things you guys shared with me, simple things, what that looks like. You know, what that looks like, and showed me what it looks like. When I got here, I didn't know how to have self-respect. It was long, long gone. And I saw it on you, and you showed me how to get it. You showed me how to have it. Not by acquisition, but by giving. All these years later, I have friends of both genders. I know how to be a friend. I know how to have a friend. If young people of any gender need to need some help, I can do that. I can be principled in the way that I help. And that's important to me. Anyway, right before my 13th AA birthday, I had to go give a talk on the other side of town, and it was a hot Sunday afternoon, and I didn't feel like going. And thank God you guys have taught me it's not how I feel, it's what I do that matters. It's my actions that matter. And so, of Of course, I went out and I gave that talk, and I mean, I used to think I could blow off a dinner for two and not be missed, really. You know, showing up was not my deal. And it's so simple and the results are so profound. Just show up. Just show up. So I went out and I gave the talk, and of course I felt better. And at the end of the meeting, when the thank you line came through, this man stopped and he said, "Where were you in 1976? And it was a guy from Hollywood Boulevard standing in front of me with 8.5 years of sobriety and I with almost 13. And only a very well-organized, loving God could have made that happen when I, in all my efforts to get it done on my own steam, just couldn't get it done, couldn't make it happen. And besides that, if I had found him when I thought I was supposed to, maybe he wouldn't have got it quite the way he did when he had 8.5 years of sobriety. So who knows? But I got to take him out to dinner and make those direct amends. I got to have that talk with him, and then I got to listen to what he had to say. And most of his sentences started with, "Are you sure you want to hear this?" And, yeah. And when we got done, he said, "My God, Carla, that's long forgiven, long forgotten. I just can't believe you're still alive." And he's right. If we're in this room today, we're the lucky ones. And I say lucky because I believe that God's grace rains on everybody. And some of us get it in this lifetime and some of us don't. Sometimes I believe that when we go, when those alcoholics and drug addicts die, sometimes I think they're just so tired that God just says, "Come on home. Come on home this time. You're done this time around. You know, just, it's okay." I left Hollywood and I hooked up with another guy from another rehab because that's where they keep the boyfriends and the partners and again, flying on the coattails of the 60s and just, you know, loving the idea of peace and love and all that stuff. We just couldn't stop knocking the heck out of each other really long enough to implement the principles fully of peace and love. So we beat each other up and down the California coast and pitched a tent in the mountains in southern Oregon and lived there till the rains came. And then we were invited by a guy who lived in a plastic tent on the other side of town up on top of a mountain to come and live in their cabin that had no roof on it. So we threw a plastic tarp over the top of that, called it a skylight, and then the baby came. And I had this little girl, and I thought, you know, after all this time, I said, I want to change the cycle. I want to break that cycle of violence and all of that stuff. I'm going to be the parent I never had, you know, and all those are great ideals. Bill talked about us having moral and philosophical convictions galore. I want to be that, but I'm stuck with this. And I haven't the least idea of how to get from here to there. And I drink. You know, and alcoholism doesn't care who you love. So I start drinking. I've got this little girl, this beautiful little girl who's supposed to be top priority. And I start to drink, and she becomes second and third and way down the line. And if you had asked me back then, I would have told you I love her. She is the most important thing in my life. But my actions couldn't say that, because alcohol is bigger than that. For me, for an alcoholic. So she got in the way of one of our fights when she was about 10 months old, and I had to take her up the road where it's got to be better somewhere else. And my first legitimate work was in the bars in Idaho, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and it never occurred to me not to drink on the job. Why else would you have that job? To me, it just seemed like I was being very efficient, quite brilliant if you ask me. And great places to work. I just could never bring home enough money to pay rent for more than a week at a time, so we lived in the rent-by-the-week motels up there. And my kid was one of those kids that you see in her T-shirt and underwear and yesterday's lunch down the front of it because the mom's not paying attention. And after a while, of course, Idaho's not working for us anymore either, so we're back down in L.A. I'm renting a room for my aunt in Covina. I've got a job in Hollywood tending bar about 35 miles away. Again, not a bad place to work. Everybody else is making a great living. It's me. I'm the common denominator. Every afternoon I'd get up, my daughter was almost 4 years old by then, I'd kiss her goodbye and I'd take off for the bar in Hollywood. I'd get thirsty about halfway, you know, halfway there, and I'd stop in a place called the First Cabin in Arcadia. And I'd stop in there and I'd have my primer drinks, you know, just rest for a minute, have a couple of shots of Cuervo and a couple of Bud Backs and get up off the bar stool and then go off and do my shift in Hollywood and crawl back home in the wee hours of the morning and start all over again. And one afternoon I kissed my girl goodbye like I had done for months on end, and I stopped at that same bar in Arcadia, had those same shots of gold and same Bud Backs. And to this day, I don't know what was different on that day from the day before except for 24 hours, because I didn't hate that job in Hollywood and I didn't love my daughter any less on that day than I love her today. But I sat on that bar stool and I drank those drinks and I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop this time. I couldn't stop long enough to get up and go see about the job. I couldn't stop long enough to get up and go see about the kid. So I sat on the bar stool and I lost them both in one fell swoop. The kid and the job were gone. And I stayed and I lived in that area off the kindness of strangers for a while until I fell into another job and another dive bar. And now the people I'm drinking with and the places I'm working and me, we're all becoming increasingly rustic. And I love that little line in the book that Bill says. It's the most beautiful understatement, and I think we all have our own version of this. He says, gradually things got worse. And I met the man in the bar who I would marry. I thought maybe if I got married and made my life look like I thought yours was, maybe that would do it. And he and I got married about the time we should have split up, and we moved into that apartment. We became the neighborhood entertainment. The way we settled our arguments was with a shotgun. Whoever gets to the gun first wins. That's how it goes in my house. I went to my first AA meeting with black eyes and broken ribs after one of our fights. We'd been at the bar where we drank, and we were fighting over whether or not I should get off the bar stool. And I lost that fight, and I ended up with black eyes and broken ribs. And our friend Mickey says, not so much the yets that bothered him, it was the oh no, not agains. Not again. And my husband had to pick me up and take me to the hospital and got fixed up, and I can't tell you the amount of times I put him at cross purposes, having to try to kill me and save my life all at the same time. And he brought me home, and he had to leave for work that weekend out of town, and before he left, he set me up with a giant ice chest full of beer and a bottle of Beefeater gin chilling on top. And now I'm drinking gin because tequila had been making me really mean. You know. And I didn't always do this, but I know that night I did. I picked up the phone, I started dialing, and I don't know all who I called, but I know I felt like a battered woman, so I called a battered woman's shelter, and I asked the woman who answered the phone to fix my life. And she asked me if I'd ever been to an AA meeting. I don't know how she made that leap, but she did. And what I heard her say was that if I went to an AA meeting, she'd fix my life. So off I went, and I found an AA meeting not far from where I lived. Of course it was there. Perfectly wonderful meeting. It was there then, it's still there. And I went there with everything but readiness, everything but willingness to do something different. Didn't even hear it. Woman speaker that night spoke for 35, 40 minutes, whatever it was, and the only thing I heard her say was that somewhere during her drinking career she switched to beer. So I did. Because beer's not really drinking. As far as I'm concerned, beer's more like it's got all those hops and barley and wheat, more like a breakfast food if you ask me, and more like whole grain breakfast food, really. But it preserved the illusion that I was controlling my drinking. It allowed me to get a little further into my day before I fell completely over and, you know, completely screwed things up. So I did that for another year and a half or two. I got my daughter back, for better or worse, when she was about 8 and a half, and from that time till she was almost 10, the hell continued, and my husband and I and she moved into a little apartment across town in Pasadena, a little tiny place, and more of the same. Finally, one Saturday afternoon, the cops are in the driveway one more time, and the neighbors are watching, and the kid's standing over in the corner in her mismatched clothes and her unkempt hair, and she got that look of fear in her eyes one more time. My life is just blown up one more time. And I didn't wake up that morning thinking, yeah, let's do this. I woke up thinking, if everybody will be cool, we'll all be all right. Everybody just calm down. There was no capacity for love or compassion or anything there. It was just survival of the fittest in three of us in a little apartment. The cops left, they took the gun, the husband left for the last time. It's me and the kid and the booze, and I can't stop drinking. See, here's where a hard drinker might take a look at their life and say, wow, I'm really sick of this. Really tired of going through this stuff. Tired of all of it. And they might even need a little help detoxing. They might even have to go for a week or two. They'd come back, they'd have a story to tell, they'd go back to work, and that would be the end of it. But for an alcoholic like me, all that caused me to do was pull the 12-pack closer to the couch so I didn't have to keep getting up to have a drink. My first sponsor told me if I wanted to affect a conscious contact with a power greater than myself, I could start by counting the coincidences that happened in my life. And, you know, here's where that relationship had just died off. You know, after a while, there was just no hope about having that contact in this lifetime for me. I just gave up. I'm on my own. I just gave up trying to have any contact like that at all. And it wasn't like I didn't believe. We'd get all cranked up sometimes and drunk and then sit and talk about God. you know, wishing that I had some kind of way. But it was out there somewhere, just so far removed from who I am and what I am. So anyway, the coincidence is I didn't know that I had moved in next door to a woman who had 5 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, and she had seen and heard that whole deal go down, and she came over a couple days later, and she brought me a big book and a 12 and 12, and she just knocked on my door, and I invited her in, and she sat on my couch, and she told me her story. Now, in her story, all she did was talk about herself, and in her story, I heard me. I heard that she drank like I did. She used to drink like I did. And what was more was that for the last year, I'd seen her, and she wasn't drinking anymore, and what impressed me more about that was it didn't seem to bother her that she wasn't drinking. That got my attention. I don't know how you do that. Because I know when I've got no booze, and I've got no steps or fellowship or God of my understanding, no sufficient substitute, my reliance on alcohol all still so great. When you take it away, I feel like you've stripped the coating off my wires. You know, I feel oversensitive and underloved, and I don't know what you meant by that or why you looked at me that way. And my head closes in on me from there. So much so that, God, when I've got no... Even though I know that the window of relief has gotten smaller and smaller and smaller, and even though I know that I can't control whether I'm going to have 2 or 22... Even though I know that I no longer have to invite trouble that comes to visit me unsolicited, even though I know all of those things about me and booze, I'm still not going to have anything that protects me from that first drink. So I don't know how her 12 little thinly veiled Sunday school sentences are going to have any effect on me in the face of what I'd become. They just seem so weak. You know, they just seem so weak. Father Tom Weston, I've heard him say many times that you have to be pretty sick and tired to find us interesting. I was becoming interested, but I still didn't believe. And the good news is you don't have to really believe to come and do this, you know. Eventually, it just, you absorb it. It happens. So it was about a week and a half later. I just didn't go back and buy any more booze, and I detoxed at home. There was just nowhere else for me to go. There was no more treatment, no more. People have been trying to help me all my life, put me in places and things and doing all that. And so I detoxed at home and shook it out and was pretty sick, and sick into Monday and into Tuesday. And by Tuesday afternoon, I went back to my neighbor instead of the store, and I asked her what to do, and she sent me up to a meeting in Sierra Madre, California, and that became my first home group. And the hope I heard that night came in the form of small talk. I don't know why it was. I was sitting way back by the open door and the exit sign, just in case. But I heard that music, heard the music of Alcoholics Anonymous, everybody talking, nobody listening, you know. But they were being kind to each other, you know. They were like, hi, Tony, do you need a ride home tonight? Did you get a big book, Kelly? Do you have a sponsor, Cheryl? Did you get a sponsor yet? How's that four-step coming, Bill? How's your lawn, Joe? Your lawn? And then it occurred to me, oh my God, could my life ever be so elegant and simple as to be concerned about a lawn again? You know, to smell fresh cut grass and to have it be that simple and beautiful. Just that. Life will take on new meaning. What are you talking about? Man, it just seemed like the last few years, progressively, it would just been about foraging for survival and seeing you as the enemy. At the end of that meeting, the secretary came and asked me to read that portion of Chapter 11, A Vision for You, that we read at the end of a lot of meetings. And as I read, I came into the room just a little bit more. Just like I do every time I say yes to something you ask me to do. Will you stack chairs? Will you make coffee? Every time I do, I'm in the room. Even when I'm not in the room. You know, my favorite commitment was that coffee commitment. My favorite job to have in a meeting was a coffee commitment. Why? Because at 5 o'clock I got off work. At 5:05 I'm in the grocery store. I'm in the meeting at 5:05 even though the meeting doesn't start till 8 o'clock because I'm looking for stir sticks and coffee and trying to remember who needs a birthday card and who needs a cake and all of that stuff. And when I'm thinking about you, I'm not interested in my problems. And I began to experience the absence of the noise on the inside of my own head. And that I wanted more of. So I kept coming, and I was coming to 2 and 3 meetings a day. I had to drink one more time at 89 days, and then I came back. had to spend 24 hours drinking, and then my sponsor came and picked me up. She helped me throw the bottles away, and then she took me up to the big book study that night, and I haven't had to have a drink since. And I'm so glad that nobody sat in that room and said, and I was not in good shape. In 24 hours, I had had a pretty good drunk. And I came in that room, and nobody said, ew, I smell alcohol in an AA meeting. They didn't say that. One guy came up to me, and he said, hey, you want to come up on Tuesday and make coffee with me? And I thought, dang, somebody thinks I'm going to be here on Tuesday. Those things helped me. They kept me in the rooms until that internal conversion could happen. And I was about 9 months sober when that obsession was finally lifted for me. And it scared me. I thought maybe I wasn't going to get it. And here I want to say this too before I forget, is that if you slip, you are always welcome. It has never been about being welcome here. You are always welcome back. The question is not that. The question is, can you? Can you? You know, if you can stay, if you can hang in without taking that drink, and really sometimes literally it is, just because you're not feeling great doesn't mean you can't stay and stay sober. You know, until we learn how to feel great and stay sober, that's what we're learning here. I believe Alcoholics Anonymous is the best place to be a mess until you don't have to be a mess anymore. It's certainly been my experience. I might be the only one. But I'm so glad that you just welcomed me back in, and I picked up the tools and started using them. But I was going to 2 and 3 meetings a day, and like I said, 9 months, the obsession was finally lifted, and it was somewhere around after the time I had started to make that first declaration of amends to my family, telling them what I knew I needed to do, and it was going to be a long road of reconstruction ahead, for sure, but I'd made that first declaration, and somewhere along the line, I realized that I hadn't had that horrible obsession on me every day like it had been for those first few months. You know what obsession sounds like, some of you, I'm sure you do. You know, it's like that kid in the grocery store following his mom around wanting chocolate. You know what I mean? Like, mom, 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 mom! It was lifted. Then other women started asking me to sponsor them, and I got to tell you, the only fifth step I like better than mine is yours. Because in your eyes, I see redeemability, I see forgivability, I see love, I see hope and growth where I don't always see it in myself. Something very special happens to two people who are sharing at that level, two alcoholics. And I'm a big believer you got to give it away to get it. It's my experience. After a couple of years, I'd had you guys, and my daughter didn't have anybody, really. I'm still busy being wonderful in AA, going to 2 and 3 meetings a day and working and, you know, just in all of that. And my daughter was 11 years old and coming home at all hours of the night, beat up and bloody if she came home at all. She'd been jumped into a gang, starting to find her sense of family and camaraderie out in the street where I used to. I'm getting worried about her. You know, she's 11. She's got 18-year-old vatos crawling in and out of her bedroom window, and she's 11. And I'm getting calls from the police department. Mrs. Moore, did you authorize this party going on in your apartment? No. And so she needed some big help. And after a while, I had to found a treatment center for her who worked with kids like that. We didn't know if she was alcoholic, if she was a drug addict. We didn't know. But she certainly was a member of this gang. And they told me that at that age, the gang influence was 10,000 was 1,000 times more toxic than drugs and alcohol in kids that age. Why? Because of the I got your back thing, because of the family thing. And well, where's your mom? Wonderful in AA. Right up front in our book, it says on page 19, a more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. So if I'm only doing it in these rooms, I'm only half doing it. Now, to be fair, I probably needed every single meeting I did until I didn't. And then it was time to go to work, go to a meeting, and go home and be a mom to that kid. And even that took time. You know, if you're new again, it's kind of hard to do justice to, you know, all of these years of screwing it up and then recovering, and then even screwing it up in recovery. You know, it's like some bad episode of Law and Order, you know, like I got the Law and Order and boom, we're good in an hour. You know, you walk away going, wow, it only took an hour. But time. That kid was 11 when it started. She'll be 38 in March. And over time, you know, we healed. She was in that treatment center for 6 months, and you guys taught me that mountains are moved a spoonful at a time, and I don't worry about the future. I don't worry about when she's going to be 37 or 38. I worry about now. I get up every day and give it my best spoonful, and that's all I can do. And when she got out, things were better, and they gradually, you know, when she was 16, she came to me, and she and her boyfriend had a funny look on their face, and I told them they were pregnant, and they nodded. But I got to tell her that I will be there no matter what you decide. It's your deal. I'm just here for support. And I got to be that as a mom. I got to be the mom I'd wanted to be forever. And I got to spend time with each of my grandsons. Now they're, God, the oldest is a junior at Arizona State, and the youngest is 15 years old, and we share a birthday every year, a natal birthday every year. And life is good that way. They haven't had to see me drunk, and I know that AA is going to be well-preserved in case they ever need it. I don't know if they do or not. I don't like to put those kind of traits on my kids if they're not drinking. If they're not drinking, I think it might be a pretty good sign. When I was 5 years sober, I came home from the gym one night, and I woke up in the middle of the night to a man standing over my bed. He had a knife, and he said, "Don't say a word or I'll cut your head off." And he took the telephone cord and he tied my hands behind my back and he raped me and he robbed me that night in my room. You know, people who never drank had problems. Why wouldn't we have problems? God wasn't shooting things at me to see how I would do. But I got still, you know, and at 5 years of sobriety, I had a much bigger God than I got here with. You know, when I got here, I told you all the disjointed ideas I had about making that connection. I just didn't know how. And a lady named Susan said, "Why don't you just call him God and let him get as big as he needs to be in your life?" And then the second step asked me to choose to believe is, do you believe God's everything or he's nothing? Well, if I choose to believe he's everything, then there's nowhere he's not. There's nowhere I can be where God is not, including in that room. You know, sometimes God is at the place where they didn't survive the accident. Sometimes God is in the play. I mean, God, it has to be. If he is everything, he's everywhere all the time, whether I like what's happening or not. And I don't know why that is. I can't define or comprehend that God. But I have to believe that there are tools at hand that I can use to walk through it. I don't believe God is in the thing that sent it. I believe that God's in the outstretched hand that says, come on, we'll walk through this too. The guy stayed for a few hours, and then we got into a little wrestling match, and he ended up going out the same window he came in, and he left the knife behind, which was a piece of evidence that really kind of clinched the deal later, which was great. It turned out that I knew this guy. I'd actually watched him get sober 30 days before I did. I watched him get his life, his wife, his kids, and everything back, and then I watched him join the church, leave AA behind. And when he went out like that. And what I chose to learn from that is that, well, the big book tells us to be quick to see where religious people are right, to make use of what they offer. This is the place where I learned the terms and conditions of my alcoholism. This is where we talk about spirituality specific to alcoholism. This was the portal. This was where I came. I didn't go anywhere else when I couldn't stop drinking. I went here. I came here. This is where I learned that I'm not one of those people who can go home after a Sunday sermon and have a glass of wine. We talk about that here. In church, lots of people can. Lots of people can do lots of things I can't as an alcoholic do. I can do some things they can't. But here's where we talk about that. There was a trial that followed. They caught him a couple weeks later, and there was a trial that followed a few months later, and as part of the defense, they had a lot of the guys I'd known years before get up and testify as to who I used to be. And that's the mark I'd, including my ex-husband, and I'd left him with a bad taste in his mouth about everything, and especially about me. And so he was more willing to testify for the rapist than he was for me. And it has to be okay. You know, I've tried to make amends over time, and he's just not interested. So we had to get a character witness for me, and by that time I'm working at an investment firm downtown Los Angeles, a big fancy place, a place I never would have even had any business walking in through the front doors of, you know, years before. People like Henry Kissinger walked the halls of this place because he was on the board. You know, when I was walking undetected, because I just showed up and did what they asked me to do. So the department head volunteered to come and testify on my behalf, and they told him all about who I used to be, and he said, yeah, but she shows up early and she stays late, and she was where she said she was. And see, that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. He didn't have to be coached. He just got up and told the truth as he's experienced it through me. And then it's my turn to testify. And, you know, when I, up until then, I'd had my sponsor, Lee, who was just a great guy. He was a good old boy. When my first sponsor left and joined the church, as far as I know, she's doing okay, but I just haven't heard from her. I had to find a new sponsor. And at the time, they were not lining up yet to sponsor me. And so I asked Lee if he would. And he was just one of those guys who'd say things like, well, that's going to feel a whole lot better as soon as it quits hurting, you know. And he didn't say that about this, but he was just very, you know, he was just very plain. And he came over. He came to my apartment, and he helped me make friends with my apartment. He put double locks all over my windows, and he helped me collect pieces of evidence that the police had overlooked. And we got all that far, and then we knew that it was time for me to find a woman to sponsor me. And he walked me right up to Marguerite, because he knows that sponsorship is not ownership. Some people will have the same sponsor for all their life. Me, I've just had a continuing education, and I get fresh horses every now and then, you know. And there's not a rule about that. We're alcoholics, one walking shoulder to shoulder, one helping another. So my sponsor, Marguerite, said, you know, you're going to have to forgive this guy. And I know she's right. I know we're people who can't handle even seemingly justifiable resentments. And yet, you know, the guy had scared me. At 5 years of sobriety, anger was still my favorite way to respond to fear. It just worked for me. It made me feel like I had a momentum, like you couldn't hurt me. And yet at 5 years of sobriety now, anger is like a suit that doesn't fit anymore. I can't be angry, can't not be angry. I don't know how to shake it. And I know it's the right thing to do. So it's my turn to testify, and I get up in the witness stand and I look out and I see him sitting there at the defense table. It's a place where I've sat before. I could sit again. If I were to take a drink, I could be sitting in his very seat. And we have a little prayer at the top of page 67 in our book that says, though we didn't like their symptoms and the way these disturbed us, they, like ourselves, are perhaps spiritually sick. They, like ourselves. I'm not forgiving from some spiritual hilltop. I'm not forgiving because I'm the bigger person. I'm forgiving because I'm the same person with the same potential for that kind of harm. And just like a little crack of light under the doorway, it felt like the forgiveness had begun, you know, at least begun. Maybe the forgiveness happened. The healing took a little longer, another 18 months before the nightmares and all of that stuff finally dissipated. But they did. Now, he was sentenced to 20 years and he did 17, but as far as I know, he's not been able to stay out of prison, because I get the letters that say he's being released. I never get the ones that say he's gone in, but I know it works. In prison, I've been up there to visit those guys. Some of them are never getting out, and yet because they've availed themselves of Alcoholics Anonymous, they walk free spiritually inside those walls. Not that they wouldn't trade places with us, but they've really made themselves useful. It works. I don't know what impresses me more, that or, you know, when I go to county, a county facility that's a lot more transient, you know, the people going through there all the time, or after a panel, then somebody will come up and say, you know, I used to be the secretary of the so-and-so meeting. I used to sponsor 20 people, used to. I just continue to do the things that you taught me to do in the first place. They're all in a different configuration now, and they'll probably change again. But in there is always one alcoholic talking to another, answering the phone, sponsoring, going to meetings. You know, meetings, I think, get a bad rap now. They're not the only thing, but they're a big thing. Meetings, fellowship. Fellowship is where we talk about all these differences. You know, like I lived in a nut house, you lived in a tree house, you know, that kind of thing. That's what makes it interesting. You know, where we hold hands while we're crossing the street. We hold hands while we're walking through the stuff. You know, there's been a lot of fun. My father doesn't have to sit up nights anymore watching the news to make sure his daughter's name isn't on the list of the victims of the serial killers of the day. He sleeps well, and he knows why. You know, he just And he doesn't have to tell me that story anymore. Until about till the time I was about 12 years sober, he had to tell me that story at least a couple times a year. You know, well, I used to have, you know, and my God, how self-centered. You know, when I was 12 years sober, I took him to eat somewhere for his birthday or something, Father's Day or something, and he's telling me this again. You know, we're sitting over spaghetti, and I've got sharp objects, you know, near me. And then one more time, he's going over the story. You know, I have no pictures of you when you were young. And it's like, what am I going to do about that? You know, what am I going to do about a thing like that? And and I'm thinking, I could just stab him. Just shut him up. Tired of this. How long do we have to keep this up? But, you know, we breathe through our nose because it keeps our mouth shut. And then he said, but I wouldn't trade who you are for today for all the pictures in the world. He said, I just know you're okay. And see, he used to have to sit up nights and watch the news. And even though he knew it wasn't rational, he thought, as long as he didn't hear my name called when people like the Green River Killer and the Hillside Strangler and those guys were out running around, he didn't have to worry. He felt like if he didn't hear my name called, he could let himself sleep. And that doesn't happen anymore. And my mother, about 2 years before I got sober, my baby sister committed suicide at the age of 17, and it took her all weekend to die. And while she lay on life support in a West Covina hospital, the family gathered in the waiting room, and then I'd leave the waiting room and I'd go out to the van where the booze was, and I'd drink, and I'd come back in, and I just raked my mother across the coals. And I talked to her in a way a daughter should never talk to her mother, especially when her baby lay dying in the next room. And I don't know how you make amends for that, except that I was told to start calling her once a week and trying to find out how I might add to her life instead of take. Now, she lived out of state, so it required some focus. And I expected a lot from my mother, a lot that I found out that she just wasn't, it wasn't in her. And I love what my sponsor today, Polly, says. She says, before you tell me your story, tell me your mother's story. Now, see, I didn't have that succinct. I eventually came to that, and she wasn't my sponsor at the time, but I love that, you know, to put myself in their shoes or to at least understand where they are. Again, better to understand than to be understood, and it mitigated that harshness that stood between us, and I didn't have to expect the things I was expecting. And over time, we became very close, and so much so that when my baby brother died of this disease, 30 years old, 6'10", 160 pounds, when he lay on life support in a Spokane hospital, mercifully, when he died, I got to go up and be the kind of a daughter my mother needed while she buried yet a second child. You know, his heart was literally disintegrating, and he wasn't going to stop drinking. And just so glad to be part of the solution instead of the problem these days. You know, and when she died just about 6 years ago of end-stage liver disease, we were clean and clear. We were just clean and clear. It was all good. And I asked my stepfather at the time, the man that she had loved for the last 30 years, the third time was a charm. It really worked. And they were just a great example of love and devotion. And my stepfather called me. He said, I know you and Doug are heading down the road to matrimony, and what I'd like to do, he said, I know that your mom left you all her jewelry, including her wedding ring, and what I'd like to do is shine mine up and give it to Doug so the rings will be together again. And so those are the rings that we wear. So these little things, you know, these things, and we each have our own version of the healing. We each had our own version of the mess, and we each have our own version of the healing. But the one thing we had in common was that somewhere along the line, we all ended up in that horrible state of alcoholism where we're either drinking or thinking about it. Drinking or thinking about it was the primary purpose of my life. And my life certainly has taken on new meaning. You wrote this little bio on the back on the program. I'd never seen that before. I thought that we were just supposed to give you guys some notes and you were going to extrapolate from that, but no. You know, done a lot of things, been a lot of things. Sobriety has been a lot of fun. And the one thing that you guys taught me is that I can try everything. Try it all. I don't want to take anything with me. I want to leave it all on the table when I'm gone. And sometimes I make terrible, terrible mistakes. I've always had some kind of connection with a power greater than myself, and I'm going to end with this story. Some kind of meditation connection in the morning, you know, sometimes reading. Used to be started off with weightlifting, you know, it's kind of meditative, and then surfing. Surfing is a wonderful way to, it's a wonderful metaphor for life. You know, the medium is always moving. You got to be ready. You know, surfing is was a good one. My friend Howard Pollins always says, wherever you see God, mark that spot and go sit in that window again. And, you know, we have a friend who sees it at the golf course. You know, he and his guys, every day do I have time? You know, the fellas get together on the golf course and they help each other take their inventories, and then they're and they get through like that. You know, that's where they see their God. So I found it on the dance floor, ballroom dance floor, for a little while. Now I have a sitting practice, not any more real, but certainly a little quieter. And I was reminded of the joy of living, you know, that we all find from taking these actions. And I was reminded of that when we adopted a little pit bull pup named Sammy a couple of years ago. And I don't know if we have any dog people in the room. Do we have dog people? Okay. Well, I don't know if you recognize, you know, everything is their favorite. Everything. Everything they do is their favorite. And I'd get up in the morning and I'd go feed Sammy. I'd put the food down in front of her. And it was the same food she saw yesterday and the day before and the day before that. Same food, different day. You know, she's just like, new attitude, new words. I can't believe we're going to eat. Eating is my favorite. Then she'd eat her food and come running into the bedroom where Doug and I were, and she'd look at him and look at me and look at him and look at me again, and the same faces she saw last night and the day before and the day before that. Same faces, different day, new attitude, new day. It's you! We're going to party. So she'd play with us for a little while, and then she'd go jetting out the doggy door, out into the same yard she was in yesterday and the day before that. Same yard, running in circles. I look out the back window, and she's like running in circles, you know, goldfish mentality. Ooh, a castle. Ooh, a castle. Ooh, a castle. Because everything's her favorite, right? And I see her in this moment, right here, right now, in this moment. The joy of living. I see it. And I realize that's in me. When I wake up and my feet hit the floor and it's thank you. Thank you are the first word. Thank you. Thank you. And then I ask God for his list for me instead of giving him mine, you know. It's a little twist. You know, when I go out and I see what I can do for somebody else, you know, and I look at my day and I get to do things, I get to. I know it sounds lame when you're new. Get to. What is this, romper room? But it's really true. I get to. And when I've got that attitude, man, my day goes well and I get to experience that joy of living and that real connection that's not only obtainable, but sustainable and expandable. You know, it doesn't just stop. If I do that every day, it gets bigger. When I forget the thank you, and I get up and I go blow right past that to the coffee pot, and I start talking to people who aren't in the room, you know, and making up scenarios that haven't happened yet, but just in case. Before I know it, I am sitting on my computer looking for a fight on Facebook. Talking to people I don't know about things I care nothing about. But it becomes very, very, very important in the moment, doesn't it? Just the difference between a thank you and use me and a not thank you and give me. So my life has taken on a new meaning. Again, I'm not so much somebody else, but more the person I believe God intended me to be. And if you're new, I hope that you'll stay and find that for yourself. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Carla. I'd like to remind everyone.